This is What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Dr. Nick Pallarino, who is a professor of practice at Georgetown Security Studies Program. Prior to that, he spent 15 years on the Hill as staff director for the Committee on Homeland Security and doing investigations into administration's terrorism policy, a year at IRI as the Pakistan country director, and maybe most notably for some, 20 years in the United States Army. Dr. Pallarino, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me, Maggie.
So you're an expert on a lot of things, particularly topics that are rather popular these days. So I think this is a good opportunity for us to ask you, what do you think are kind of the top security concerns for the new administration?
Well, expert is a broad term, but I've had experience in several things over my 50-plus years career. And security has been one of them. And I think there's quite a few security challenges out there on the horizon for this administration. You have, of course, China, and that's a security challenge in Southeast Asia and in Asia in general. You have the Middle East, which is always a security challenge. There just seems to be so much turmoil in the Middle East, and especially after the Arab Spring, it's really an Arab winter, if you will. you also have to look at areas like Europe and what's going on in Europe and in Asia, if you will, with Russia and the Ukraine and the Crimea. The North Koreans are certainly going to be a challenge in the future, and we're not really sure what's going to happen between North and South Korea. And with an unstable regime like you do have in North Korea, you're always going to find a bit of turmoil and a bit of concern. So those are some of the challenges that I see on the horizon. So within these regions, for example, the Middle East, you're going to see groups like the Islamic State peak and wane, if you will, and they are certainly spreading into other parts of the world. And that's always a concern. These Islamic jihadist movements are always going to be a problem for the future.
So problems, in theory, have solutions, or we like when they have solutions. So you are, of course, a professor of practice, and in full disclosure, you are also my professor. So I feel it's only appropriate for me to ask, from a theoretical perspective, what tools do you see as being the most successful to combat these challenges and problems and maybe find some solutions for them?
And just for the record, Maggie has been a good student.
Thank you.
You know, as policymakers, I've been on both sides of it, policymaker and academic. And as I go out and I look at the world, I think about the different theories that we have to understand our world. Realism, liberalism or institutionalism, and constructivism. Realism, we think about power. Institutionalism, we think about institutions and nations coming together to help solve our problem. And constructivism, we think about ideas. And these are basically some of the established theories that we have to look at the world as we see it, to try to understand the world. And we use those perspectives, but we need to step out of the box of those three established, if you will, theories, and we need to look at the world through a Fukuyama lens and democracy. We need to look at the world through a Huntington lens of a clash of, not so much clash of civilizations, but a clash within civilizations. And then we also have to look at the world through Tom Friedman's eyes of a if you will, globalization, and what he calls the Lexus and the Nexus. The Lexus being the Western world intruding into established traditions, like countries with olive trees, if you will, and how we, the Western world, have invaded these traditionalist countries and their reaction to those Western values, if you will. So we need to think outside the box. We need to think outside these theories and open ourselves up to a different way to look at these security challenges we have on the horizon.
So I think for a lot of people, theory is kind of this high and mighty tool that exists on a cloud somewhere. But through your experience on the Hill and at IRI and also in the Army, you know, you turn theory into practice, right? That's a big part of what you do. And something I know you've been working on in countering violent extremism is trying to figure out how to do that. How do you counter violent extremism? So what are you working on there, and how do you think it plays into using these various theories as lenses to see the world?
That's a good question. So as I had the opportunity to learn and understand these different theories, and as I went through my graduate program and into my PhD program, I basically accepted the realist paradigm.
You basically accepted it, I think.
Sure,
I basically
I basically accepted it. But then when I went out and I traveled the world, I tried to use a realist paradigm, an institutional perspective, and to understand the world. But they don't always fit. Realism doesn't really take into account sub-state actors.
Sure.
Institutionalists can't really deal with sub-state actors in a lot of cases. So you have to look at other theories, like Huntington's clash within civilizations, to understand what these sub-state actors are doing out there and how these sub-state actors are actually threatening the traditionalist states and the governments within these states. They want to, from a jihadist movement perspective, eliminate state borders. And we have to understand that. And we can't always just use one lens to understand what's going on out there in our world. We have to look at in a broader sense of take elements and parts of all these different theories and try to put them together to understand our world. For example, realists talk about power and states, and states as the primary actors. Well, of course, states are certainly the primary actors, but you have to understand that there's a challenge to those states from sub-state actors. You have to understand that institutions are certainly good to try to solve some of the security problems and other problems of the world, but institutions are sometimes ineffective, and because it's difficult to bring all these institutions together. So we have to take into account that there are other, if you will, power centers out there that are challenging the states. And I don't see that with just using a realist or an institutionalist perspective.
So knowing that these theories kind of fall short when it comes to reality, how has that informed kind of the choices you've made and methodology to combat extremism? Are there programming choices that you saw through your time at IRI or through work you're doing now that take these theories into account, but kind of make them operational and recognize their shortfalls?
So what I've tried to do is, especially in classes where you have graduate students who are smart and try to look at the world from a different perspective, is to challenge the students and say, okay, when you get out there and you're in policymaking positions, you need to think outside the box. But that's not the only way I've tried to do it. When I was working on the Hill, I tried to challenge my bosses, not that I'm smarter than they are, but try to get them to understand that there's not only one way to look at the world. There's many different ways. So what I would do is I would bring in academics. I'd bring in academics to the hearings that we'd have on the security challenges we faced. We brought in people like Bruce Hoffman, who is an expert on terrorism, on jihadist movements, and let them get to the hearing table so that they could explain to these members of Congress what the world looks like from a terrorist perspective. This way you have, if you will, a dialogue. You're thinking outside the box. You're bringing different perspectives in and different ways to deal with these challenges. For example, the jihadist movements out there. You can't kill them all. There's just no way you're going to be able to do that. But you can attempt to counter their ideology. And how you counter that ideology is very important. If you have a Western nation that's trying to counter the ideology, it's not going to work. You have to have people from the Islamic community countering this ideology. You know, we talk a lot about modern Muslims, but there are modern Muslims out there that don't adhere to radical Islam. They just don't. They don't find it acceptable. So you have to have these type of people that are on the blog, on the blogs, on the internet, trying to counter the ideology. Another group, if you will, are Islamic State defectors or jihadist movement defectors. You need to get them on the blogs to explain how they became radicalized, what they saw, how they got to, for example, Syria, Iraq, what they saw there, what they saw from these barbarians, and how they rejected it, escaped, and now they should be the ones that are telling their story about how these barbarians are, what they're doing in these different countries.
And in doing that work and showing those voices and kind of letting those with the actual experience and kind of validity to people that are considering joining radicalist movements, what kind of success have you seen with that? Or is it hard to measure because you can't measure something that doesn't happen?
Well, you can measure it, but it's got to be measured over a long period of time. And that's one of the questions that you're asked when you go in and say pitch this contract, if you will, to the U.S. government. You say, okay, we want to start a project where we find Islamic defectors, get them on the internet so that they can tell their stories about what these barbarians are really like. And they ask you, okay, how can we determine whether or not that's successful? Well, you can't really determine whether it's successful right away.
Right.
But you can kind of document the number of people that are going to join the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda, if you will, in the long run. That will kind of give you a sense that maybe that program is working.
So you're someone who has what some people might call more traditional experience, right? You were in the military, spent a lot of time on the Hill. and are someone who I know has deep admiration and respect for Ronald Reagan. So I imagine that when people have this conversation with you, right, here you are advocating for blogs instead of just bombing everybody. Do you find that you get farther coming from the position that you're in, that your voice carries more weight with people who might otherwise consider themselves quote-unquote hawks than someone who seems like an outsider or someone who's into more of the, like, touchy-feely aspects of diplomacy?
Well, I think, well, that's a good question, but I think that, don't get me wrong, I don't have a problem with eliminating barbarians militarily. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's, in many cases, it's the right thing to do.
Right.
But as I said before, I understand that you can't kill them all.
Right.
And I also understand that we have to find a way to counter the ideology of hate that's been fermented in this these jihadist movements. And the way to do that is with people who have come out of those jihadist movements that have basically rejected it.
Sure.
They're the ones that have to tell their stories. We can't tell that story from a Western perspective. They have to tell that story. And as far as being accepted as kind of a middle of the roader, I may be a middle of the roader, but I've been out there. I've lived among in Muslim nations. I think I understand them. I think I understand where they're coming from. And we just can't kill them all. That's, you know, I can't say that enough. We just can't kill them all.
Have you found any pushback to that, you know, when you were working on the Hill or even at IRI? You know, do you find that people who are used to this idea of, you know, I found an enemy I can kill, like, don't try to persuade me otherwise. Have you found pushback, and kind of what have you said to them to make them reconsider?
Sure. You always find people that are out there that basically say, we need to kill our way out of this thing.
Right.
But from a person, and I don't mean to blow my own horn, but from a person like me that's been out there,
right,
that understands this issue, if you sit down and explain your point of view to someone that wants to just kill them and kill them, they understand a dual-track approach, if you will.
Yeah.
They understand a military approach and a counter-ideological approach. And it's, in the long run, that counter-ideological approach is going to win over, if you will, the approach that's just killing people all the time.
Absolutely. And thinking about kind of what you've been saying in terms of using theory as tools and picking the bits and pieces that are the most useful when it's the right time, one thing that I think you've certainly developed a reputation for throughout D.C., you know, on the Hill, on campus, wherever, is being somebody who is not afraid to pluck people and serve as a mentor, right? And there's a lot of discussion, you know, something that ASP is working on is a program for young women interested in security. And you are somebody who has not been shy about reaching out to people who are your interns or students or whatever else, man or woman, doesn't matter, and saying, hey, you should consider this or think through whatever else. And I wonder how you see this idea of bringing people into the conversation and into the fold who maybe this wasn't a career path they would have considered otherwise, as similar to this idea of using the old theories to make something new, right? Bringing in a new, fresh blood, so to speak, because if you keep using what you've always used, you only get what you've always gotten. And I think we're certainly in a place where we need to try something else. And you're someone who tries that. So what is that experience like to you now after being on the Hill?
So I know, Maggie, from our discussions in class, that you don't always agree with my political persuasions.
Absolutely.
But I just want you to understand that that's one of the reasons I was for Donald Trump, because he challenged the establishment. And let's face it, he made a lot of good points about the establishment, that they continued to use the same practices over and over. And he challenged that establishment. I like to challenge the establishment. And I like to bring new voices, new faces, new ideas in from young people who do have new voices, new ideas. When I worked in Pakistan, I found that there were these political parties that had a hierarchy, and they would not let the junior people through that hierarchy. And it was the same people over and over again that used the same ideas over and over again. And in a lot of cases, it didn't work. So I'm a believer of bringing young people up and raising these young people up. When I was on the Hill as a subcommittee staff director or deputy staff director, if you will, I'd always use the interns.
Yeah.
The young interns that came in. And I'd get them in my office early in the morning, and I'd say, I want a paper from you on this situation that's happening right now on terrorism. And I want it by 10 o'clock. And I would say to the other intern, I want the same paper from you, and I'd want it by 10 o'clock. And I'd let them compete.
Death match, if you will, of the interns.
Of course.
Yeah.
And they'd have those papers into me at 10 o'clock in the morning. And you would be amazed at the ideas and the analysis they came out with. It was great. And then, of course, it was my job to go up to my boss and brief him on whatever idea I thought was best. But that way you would get some pretty good ideas from different perspectives. And that's what you want to do in government, I think. You just don't want to listen to the establishment over and over. It gets really, really boring. Sorry, it does.
I believe that. And it sounds like there, you know, it's certainly from ASP's perspective, that there's an argument to be made that just like updating these theories, updating these voices is in the best interest of our national security, right? Because you need these different perspectives and you need these different ideas. And do you think that perhaps that is something, you know, when you talk about the challenges for the next administration, that an opportunity to bring in fresh perspectives will result in more opportunities than challenges?
Well, I think both things can happen, because when you bring new ideas in, sometimes they don't always work.
It gets a little crazy, yeah.
It gets a little crazy. But it's up to the leadership to, if you will, sift through those new ideas, those challenges that we're facing, and guide us through that. And to be quite frank with you, if there's one thing that I'm hesitant about, mm-hmm. with the new Trump administration coming in, is that some of them may not have the experience to guide us through that.
Sure.
So we do have to be careful.
Sure.
And that's where transparency in the news media needs to come in. They mm-hmm. really need to challenge Mr. Trump and his administration as they move forward. And I'm all for challenging a new administration.
I would say that is in keeping with almost everything else you've ever said. So if you were to make the case to a new administration on terrorism policy, or maybe not even make the case, but look at what they propose. What are you looking for as kind of key pieces of that policy that could get us to our definition of success?
Definition of success to counterterrorism.
That's a whole other podcast.
No, it's a hard question, but I would say from working on this for the past 15 years is to attempt to craft your policy where you have a dual-track approach.
Mm-hmm.
One, do not ever let down the military aspects of it, whether it be working through surrogates on the ground with nations like Jordan, like Israel, like Saudi Arabia in some cases, like Bahrain, like Abu Dhabi, or the UAE, to help us counter this jihadist movement militarily. But at the same time, you really need to fund that counter ideology program that's out there. You really need to put the money and the resources behind it to counter their ideology. Because if you don't, that ideology is going to continue to grow and fester and move into other countries of the world. And, you know, we're seeing that in so many different places, in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in Afghanistan, Pakistan region. That ideology will spread and continue to spread, and you need to counter that. So it's a dual-track approach that you need to actually push forward as the next administration moves forward.
So, Nick, our last question is always, what's next? So I ask you, what's next, and what does the world look like in 10, 15 years?
I think the world will be much the same as we see it now. I think the United States will continue to be the preeminent power in the world, but I think you'll see countries like Russia, China, and possibly other nations challenging that power. And they will continue to challenge the power of the United States. But I also see the threat of the jihadist movements challenging many states around the globe. And the United States is going to have to determine whether or not we want to continue to counter those jihadist movements and how we counter the jihadist movements. And I think we ought to counter it in two ways. One, militarily, but also ideological. We need to counter their ideological message and be prepared, if that does not work, to use military means to counter that jihadist movement. So that's the way that I see the world maybe 10, 15 years down the road.
Well, Dr. Nick Pallarino, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity, and good luck on your examination in the future,
thank
Maggie.
You. This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch.